presents an unabridged recording of The Key to Rebecca by Ken Follett, narrated by Peter Fernandez. This book is copyrighted 1979 and 1980 by Fine Blend NV. This performance is copyrighted 1989 by Recorded Books Incorporated. In the desert, the Nazis had Rommel. In Cairo, they had an even more deadly weapon. His name, Alex Wolff. His code name, the Sphinx. His mission, to send Rommel's advancing army the secrets that would unlock the doors to Cairo and lead to ultimate Nazi triumph in the war. And now, The Key to Rebecca.
Part 1. Tobruk. Chapter 1. The last camel collapsed at noon. It was the 5-year-old white bull he had bought in Giallo, the youngest and strongest of the three beasts, and the least ill-tempered. He liked the animal as much as a man could like a camel, which is to say that he hated it only a little. They climbed the leeward side of a small hill, man and camel planting big clumsy feet in the inconstant sand, and at the top they stopped. They looked ahead, seeing nothing but another hillock to climb, and after that 1,000 more, and it was as if the camel despaired at the thought. Its forelegs folded, then its rear went down, and it couched on top of the hill like a monument, staring across the empty desert with the indifference of the dying. The man hauled on its nose rope. Its head came forward, and its neck stretched out, but it would not get up. The man went behind and kicked its hindquarters as hard as he could, 3 or 4 times. Finally, he took out a razor-sharp curved Bedouin knife with a narrow point and stabbed the camel's rump. Blood flowed from the wound, but the camel did not even look around. The man understood what was happening. The very tissues of the animal's body, starved of nourishment, had simply stopped working, like a machine that has run out of fuel. He had seen camels collapse like this on the outskirts of an oasis, surrounded by life-giving foliage which they ignored, lacking the energy to eat. There were 2 more tricks he might have tried. One was to pour water into its nostrils until it began to drown, the other to light a fire under its hind quarters. He could not spare the water for one, nor the firewood for the other, and besides, neither method had a great chance of success. It was time to stop anyway. The sun was high and fierce. The long Saharan summer was beginning, and the midday temperature would reach 110 degrees in the shade. Without unloading the camel, the man opened one of his bags and took out his tent. He looked around again, automatically. There was no shade or shelter in sight. One place was as bad as another. He pitched his tent beside the dying camel, there on top of the hillock. He sat cross-legged in the open end of the tent to make his tea. He scraped level a small square of sand, arranged a few precious dry twigs in a pyramid, and lit the fire. When the kettle boiled, he made tea in the nomad fashion, pouring it from the pot into the cup, adding sugar, then returning it to the pot to infuse again several times over. The resulting brew, very strong and rather treacly, was the most revivifying drink in the world. He gnawed at some dates and watched the camel die while he waited for the sun to pass overhead. His tranquility was practiced. He had come a long way in this desert, more than 1,000 miles. 2 months earlier, he had left El Agheila on the Mediterranean coast of Libya and traveled due south for 500 miles via Giallo and Kufra into the empty heart of the Sahara. There he had turned east and crossed the border into Egypt unobserved by man or beast. He had traversed the rocky wasteland of the western desert and turned north near Karga. And now he was not far from his destination. He knew the desert, but he was afraid of it. All intelligent men were, even the nomads who lived all their lives here. But he never allowed that fear to take hold of him, to panic him, to use up his nervous energy. There were always catastrophes, mistakes in navigation that made you miss a well by a couple of miles, water bottles that leaked or burst. apparently healthy camels that got sick a couple of days out. The only response was to say, "Inshallah, it is the will of God." Eventually, the sun began to dip toward the west. He looked at the camel's load, wondering how much of it he could carry. There were 3 small European suitcases, 2 heavy and 1 light, all important. There was a little bag of clothes, a sextant, the maps, the food, and the water bottle. It was already too much. He would have to abandon the tent, the tea set, the cooking pot, the almanac, and the saddle. He made the 3 cases into a bundle and tied the clothes, the food, and the sextant on top, strapping the lot together with a length of cloth. He could put his arms through the cloth straps and carry the load like a rucksack on his back. He slung the goatskin water bag around his neck and let it dangle in front. It was a heavy load. 3 months earlier, he would have been able to carry it all day, then play tennis in the evening, for he was a strong man. But the desert had weakened him. His bowels were water. His skin was a mass of sores, and he had lost 20 or 30 pounds. Without the camel, he could not go far. Holding his compass in his hand, he started walking. He followed the compass wherever it led, resisting the temptation to divert around the hills, for he was navigating by dead reckoning over the final miles, and a fractional error could take him a fatal few hundred yards astray. He settled into a slow, long-strided walk, his mind emptied of hopes and fears, and he concentrated on the compass and the sand. He managed to forget the pain of his ravaged body and put one foot in front of the other automatically, without thought, and therefore without effort. The day cooled into evening. The water bottle became lighter around his neck as he consumed its contents. He refused to think about how much water was left. He was drinking 6 pints a day, he had calculated, and he knew there was not enough for another day. A flock of birds flew over his head, whistling noisily. He looked up, shading his eyes with his hand, and recognized them as Liechtenstein's sand grouse, desert birds like brown pigeons that flock to water every morning and evening. They were heading the same way as he was, which meant he was on the right track. But he knew they could fly 50 miles to water, so he could take little encouragement from them. Clouds gathered on the horizon as the desert cooled. Behind him, the sun sank lower and turned into a big yellow balloon. A little while later, a white moon appeared in a purple sky. He thought about stopping. Nobody could walk all night, but he had no tent, no blanket, no rice, and no tea. And he was sure he was close to the well. By his reckoning, he should have been there. He walked on. His calm was deserting him now. He had set his strength and his expertise against the ruthless desert, and it began to look as if the desert would win. He thought again of the camel he had left behind, and how it had sat on the hillock with the tranquility of exhaustion, waiting for death. He would not wait for death, he thought. When it became inevitable, he would rush to meet it. Not for him the hours of agony and encroaching madness. That would be undignified. He had his knife. The thought made him feel desperate, and now he could no longer repress the fear. The moon went down, but the landscape was bright with starlight. He saw his mother in the distance, and she said, "Don't say I never warned you." He heard a railway train that chugged along with his heartbeat. Slowly. Small rocks moved in his path like scampering rats. He smelled roast lamb. He breasted a rise and saw, close by, a red glow of the fire over which the meat had been roasted, and a small boy beside it, gnawing the bones. There were the tents around the fire, the hobbled camels grazing the scattered thorns, and the wellhead beyond. He walked into the hallucination. The people in the dream looked up at him. Startled. A tall man stood up and spoke. The traveler pulled at his howli, partially unwinding the cloth to reveal his face. The tall man stepped forward, shocked, and said, "My cousin!" The traveler understood that this was not, after all, an illusion, and he smiled faintly and collapsed. When he awoke, he thought for a moment that he was a boy again, and that his adult life had been a dream. Someone was touching his shoulder and saying, "Wake up, Ahmed," in the tongue of the desert. Nobody had called him Ahmed for years. He realized he was wrapped in a coarse blanket and lying on the cold sand, his head swathed in a howli. He opened his eyes to see the gorgeous sunrise, like a straight rainbow against the flat black horizon. The icy morning wind blew into his face. In that instant, he experienced again all the confusion and anxiety of his 15th year. He had felt utterly lost that first time he woke up in a desert. He had thought, "My father is dead." And then, "I have a new father." Snatches from the surahs of the Quran had run through his head, mixed with bits of the creed, which his mother still taught him secretly in German. He remembered the recent sharp pain of his adolescent circumcision, followed by the cheers and rifle shots of the men as they congratulated him on at last becoming one of them, a true man. Then there had been the long train journey, wondering what his desert cousins would be like, and whether they would despise his pale body and his city ways. He had walked briskly out of the railway station and seen the two Arabs sitting beside their camels in the dust of the station yard, wrapped in traditional robes, which covered them from head to foot except for the slit in the howli, which revealed only their dark, unreadable eyes. They had taken him to the well. It had been terrifying. Nobody had spoken to him, except in gestures. In the evening, he had realized that these people had no toilets, and he became desperately embarrassed. In the end, he had been forced to ask. There was a moment of silence. Then they all burst out laughing. It transpired that they had thought he could not speak their language, which was why everyone had tried to communicate with him in signs, and that he had used a baby word in asking about toilet arrangements, which made it funnier. Someone had explained to him about walking a little way beyond the circle of tents and squatting in the sand, and after that he had not been so frightened, for although these were hard men, they were not unkind. All these thoughts had run through his mind as he looked at his first desert sunrise, and they came back again 20 years later, as fresh and as painful as yesterday's bad memories, with the words, "Wake up, Ahmed." He sat up abruptly, the old thoughts clearing rapidly like the morning clouds. He had crossed the desert on a vitally important mission. He had found the well, and it had not been a hallucination. His cousins were here, as they always were at this time of the year. He had collapsed with exhaustion, and they had wrapped him in blankets and let him sleep by the fire. He suffered a sudden sharp panic as he thought of his precious baggage. Had he still been carrying it when he arrived? Then he saw it, piled neatly at his feet. Ishmael was squatting beside him. It had always been like this. Throughout the year the two boys had spent together in the desert, Ishmael had never failed to wake first in the morning. Now he said, "Heavy worries, cousin." Ahmed nodded. "There is a war." Ishmael proffered a tiny jeweled bowl containing water. Ahmed dipped his fingers in the water and washed his eyes. Ishmael went away. Ahmed stood up. One of the women, silent and subservient, gave him tea. He took it without thanking her and drank it quickly. He ate some cold boiled rice while the unhurried work of the encampment went on around him. It seemed that this branch of the family was still wealthy. There were several servants, many children, and more than 20 camels. The sheep nearby were only a part of the flock. The rest would be grazing a few miles away. There would be more camels, too. They wandered at night in search of foliage to eat, and although they were hobbled, they sometimes went out of sight. The young boys would be rounding them up now, as he and Ishmael had done. The beasts had no names, but Ishmael knew each one individually and its history. He would say, "This is the bull my father gave to his brother Abdel in the year many women died, and the bull became lame, so my father gave Abdel another, and took this one back, and it still limps, see?" Ahmed had come to know camels well, but he had never quite adopted the nomad attitude to them. He had not, he remembered, lit a fire underneath his dying white yesterday. Ishmael would have. Ahmed finished his breakfast and went back to his baggage. The cases were not locked. He opened the top one, a small leather suitcase, and when he looked at the switches and dials of the compact radio neatly fitted into the rectangular case, he had a sudden vivid memory, like a movie. The bustling, frantic city of Berlin. A tree-lined street, called the Terpitzufer. A four-story sandstone building, a maze of hallways and staircases. An outer office with two secretaries. An inner office, sparsely furnished with desk, sofa, filing cabinet, small bed, and on the wall a Japanese painting of a grinning demon and a signed photograph of Franco. And beyond the office, on a balcony overlooking the Lanvert Canal, a pair of dachshunds and a prematurely white-haired admiral who said, "Rummer wants me to put an agent into Cairo." The case also contained a book, a novel in English. Idly, Ahmed read the first line. "Last night I dreamt I went to Manderley again." A folded sheet of paper fell from between the leaves of the book. Carefully, Ahmed picked it up and put it back. He closed the book, replaced it in the case, and closed the case. Ishmael was standing at his shoulder. He said, "Was it a long journey?" Ahmed nodded. "I came from El Agila in Libya." The names meant nothing to his cousin. "I came from the sea."
"From the sea?"
"Yes."
"Alone?"
"I had some camels when I started." Ishmael was awestruck. Even the nomads did not make such long journeys, and he had never seen the sea. He said,
"But why?"
"It is to do with this war.
One gang of Europeans fighting with another over who shall sit in Cairo. What does this matter to the sons of the desert?"
"My mother's people are in the war," Ahmed said.
"A man should follow his father."
"And if he has two fathers?" Ishmael shrugged. He understood dilemmas. Ahmed lifted the closed suitcase. "Will you keep this for me?"
"Yes."
Ishmael took it.
"Who is winning the war?"
"My mother's people. They are like the nomads. They are proud and cruel and strong. They are going to rule the world." Ishmael smiled.
"Ahmed, you always did believe in the desert lion."
Ahmed remembered. He had learned in school that there had once been lions in the desert, and that it was possible a few of them remained, hiding in the mountains, living off deer and fennec fox and wild sheep. Ishmael had refused to believe him. The argument had seemed terribly important then, and they had almost quarreled over it. Ahmed grinned. "I still believe in the desert lion," he said. The two cousins looked at one another. It was 5 years since the last time they had met. The world had changed. Ahmed thought of the things he could tell, the crucial meeting in Beirut in 1938, his trip to Berlin, his great coup in Istanbul. None of it would mean anything to his cousin, and Ishmael was probably thinking the same about the events of his last 5 years. Since they had gone together as boys on the pilgrimage to Mecca, they had loved each other fiercely, but they never had anything to talk about. After a moment, Ishmael turned away and took the case to his tent. Ahmed fetched a little water in a bowl. He opened another bag and took out a small piece of soap, a brush, a mirror, and a razor. He stuck the mirror in the sand, adjusted it, and began to unwind the howlie from around his head. The sight of his own face in the mirror shocked him. His strong, normally clear forehead was covered with sores. His eyes were hooded with pain and lined in the corners. The dark beard grew matted and unkempt on his fine-boned cheeks, and the skin of his large hooked nose was red and split. He parted his blistered lips and saw that his fine, even teeth were filthy and stained. He brushed the soap on and began to shave. Gradually, his old face emerged. It was strong rather than handsome, and normally wore a look which he recognized, in his more detached moments, to be faintly dissolute. But now it was simply ravaged. He had brought a small phial of scented lotion across hundreds of miles of desert for this moment, But now he did not put it on, because he knew it would sting unbearably. He gave it to a girl child who had been watching him, and she ran away, delighted with her prize. He carried his bag into Ishmael's tent and shooed out the women. He took off his desert robes and donned a white English shirt, a striped tie, gray socks, and a brown checked suit. When he tried to put on the shoes, he discovered that his feet had swollen. It was agonizing to attempt to force them into the hard new leather. However, he could not wear his European suit with the improvised rubber tire sandals of the desert. In the end, he slit the shoes with his curved knife and wore them loose. He wanted more: a hot bath, a haircut, cool soothing cream for his sores, a silk shirt, a gold bracelet, a cold bottle of champagne, and a warm, soft woman. For those, he would have to wait. When he emerged from the tent, the nomads looked at him as if he were a stranger. He picked up his hat and hefted the two remaining cases, one heavy, one light. Ishmael came to him carrying a goatskin water bottle. The two cousins embraced. Ahmed took a wallet from the pocket of his jacket to check his papers. Looking at the identity card, he realized that once again he was Alexander Wolf, age 34, of Villa Les Oliviers, Garden City, Cairo, a businessman, race, European. He put on his hat, picked up his cases, and set off in the cool of the dawn to walk across the last few miles of desert to the town. The great and ancient caravan route, which Wolf had followed from oasis to oasis across the vast empty desert, led through a pass in the mountain range and at last merged with an ordinary modern road. The road was like a line drawn on the map by God, for on one side were the yellow, dusty, barren hills, and on the other were lush fields of cotton squared off with irrigation ditches. The peasants, bent over their crops, wore galabiyas, simple shifts of striped cotton, instead of the cumbersome protective robes of the nomads. Walking north on the road, smelling the cool damp breeze off the nearby Nile, observing the increasing signs of urban civilization, Wolf began to feel human again. The peasants dotted about the fields came to seem less like a crowd. Finally, he heard the engine of a car, and he knew he was safe. The vehicle was approaching him from the direction of Asyut, the town. It came around a bend and into sight, and he recognized it as a military jeep. As it came closer, he saw the British Army uniforms of the men in it, and he realized he had left behind one danger, only to face another. Deliberately, he made himself calm. "I have every right to be here," he thought. "I was born in Alexandria. I am Egyptian by nationality. I own a house in Cairo. My papers are all genuine. I am a wealthy man, a European, and a German spy behind enemy lines." The jeep screeched to a halt in a cloud of dust. One of the men jumped out. He had three cloth pips uniform shirt, a captain. He looked terribly young and walked with a limp. The captain said, "Where the devil have you come from?" Wolf put down his cases and jerked a thumb back over his shoulder. "My car broke down on the desert road." The captain nodded, accepting the explanation instantly. It would never have occurred to him, or to anyone else, that a European might have walked here from Libya. He said, "I'd better see your papers, please." Wolf handed them over. The captain examined them, then looked up. Wolf thought, "There has been a leak from Berlin, and every officer in Egypt is looking for me. Or they have changed the papers since last time I was here, and mine are out of date, or..." "You look about all in, Mr. Wolf," the captain said. "How long have you been walking?" Wolf realized that his ravaged appearance might get some useful sympathy from another European. "Since yesterday afternoon," he said with a weariness that was not entirely faked. "I got a bit lost." "You've been out here all night?" The captain looked more closely at Wolf's face. "Good Lord, I believe you have. You'd better have a lift with us." He turned to the jeep. "Corporal, take the gentleman's cases." Wolf opened his mouth to protest, then shut it again abruptly. A man who had been walking all night would be only too glad to have someone take his luggage. to object would not only discredit his story, it would draw attention to the bags. As the corporal hefted them into the back of the jeep, Wolf realized with a sinking feeling that he had not even bothered to lock them. How could I be so stupid, he thought. He knew the answer. He was still in tune with the desert, where you were lucky to see other people once a week, and the last thing they wanted to steal was a radio transmitter that had to be plugged into a power outlet. His senses were alert to all the wrong things. He was watching the movement of the sun, smelling the air for water, measuring the distances he was traveling, and scanning the horizon as if searching for a lone tree in whose shade he could rest during the heat of the day. He had to forget all that now, and think instead of policemen and papers and locks and lies. He resolved to take more care and climbed into the jeep. The captain got in beside him and said to the driver, "Back into town." Wolf decided to bolster his story. As the jeep turned in the dusty road, he said, "Have you got any water?" "Of course." The captain reached beneath his seat and pulled up a tin bottle covered in felt, like a large whiskey flask. He unscrewed the cap and handed it to Wolf. Wolf drank deeply, swallowing at least a pint. "Thanks," he said, and handed it back. "Quite a thirst you had. Not surprising. Oh, by the way, I'm Captain Newman." He stuck out his hand. Wolf shook it and looked more closely at the man. He was young, early 20s at a guess, and fresh-faced, with a boyish forelock and a ready smile. But there was in his demeanor that weary maturity that comes early to fighting men. Wolf asked him, "Seen any action?" "Some." Captain Newman touched his own knee. "Did the leg at Cyrenaica. That's why they sent me to this one-horse town." He grinned. "I can't honestly say I'm panting to get back into the desert, but I'd like to be doing something a bit more positive than this, minding the shop hundreds of miles from the war. The only fighting we ever see is between the Christians and the Muslims in the town. Where does your accent come from?" The sudden question, unconnected with what had gone before, took Wolf by surprise. It had surely been intended to, he thought. Captain Newman was a sharp-witted young man. Fortunately, Wolf had a prepared answer. "My parents were Boers who came from South Africa to Egypt. I grew up speaking Afrikaans and Arabic." He hesitated, nervous of overplaying his hand by seeming too eager to explain. "The name Wolf is Dutch, originally, and I was christened Alex after the town where I was born." Newman seemed politely interested. "What brings you here?" Wolf had prepared for that one, too. "I have business interests in several towns in Upper Egypt." He smiled. "I like to pay them surprise visits." They were entering Asyut. By Egyptian standards, it was a large town, with factories, hospitals, a Muslim university, a famous convent, and some 60,000 inhabitants. Wolf was about to ask to be dropped at the railway station when Newman saved him from that error. "You need a garage," the captain said. "We'll take you to Nassif's. He has a tow truck." Wolf forced himself to say, "Thank you." He swallowed dryly. He was still not thinking hard enough or fast enough. "I wish I could pull myself together," he thought. "It's the damn desert. It slowed me down." He looked at his watch. He had time to go through a charade at the garage and still catch the daily train to Cairo. He considered what he would do. He would have to go into the place, for Newman would watch. Then the soldiers would drive away. Wolf would have to make some inquiries about car parts or something, then take his leave and walk to the station. With luck, Nassif and Newman might never compare notes on the subject of Alex Wolf. The jeep drove through the busy, narrow streets. The familiar sights of an Egyptian town pleased Wolf. The gay cotton clothes, the women carrying bundles on their heads, the officious policemen, the sharp characters in sunglasses, the tiny shops spilling out into the rutted streets, the stalls, the battered cars, and the overloaded asses. They stopped in front of a row of low mud-brick buildings. The road was half-blocked by an ancient truck and the remains of a cannibalized Fiat. A small boy was working on a cylinder block with a wrench, sitting on the ground outside the entrance. Newman said, "I'll have to leave you here, I'm afraid. Duty calls." Wolf shook his hand. "You've been very kind." "I don't like to dump you this way," Newman continued. "You've had a bad time." He frowned, then his face cleared. "Tell you what, I'll leave Corporal Cox to look after you." Wolf said, "It's kind, but really..." Newman was not listening. "Get the man's bags, Cox, and look sharp. I want you to take care of him. And don't you leave anything to the Wogs, understand?" "Yes, sir," said Cox. Wolf groaned inwardly. Now there would be more delay while he got rid of the corporal. Captain Newman's kindness was becoming a nuisance. Could that possibly be intentional? Wolf and Cox got out, and the jeep pulled away. Wolf walked into Nassif's workshop, and Cox followed, carrying the cases. Nassif was a smiling young man in a filthy galabiyah, working on a car battery by the light of an oil lamp. He spoke to them in English. "You want to rent a beautiful automobile? My brother have Bentley." Wolf interrupted him in rapid Egyptian Arabic. "My car has broken down. They say you have a tow truck."
"Yes, we can leave right away. Where is the car?"
"On the desert road, 40 or 50 miles out. It's a Ford, but we're not coming with you." He took out his wallet and gave Nassif an English pound note. "You'll find me at the Grand Hotel by the railway station when you return." Nassif took the money with alacrity.
"Very good. I leave immediately."
Wolf nodded curtly and turned around. Walking out of the workshop with Cox in tow, he considered the implications of his short conversation with Nassif. The mechanic would go out into the desert with his tow truck and search the road for the car. Eventually, he would return to the Grand Hotel to confess failure. He would learn that Wolf had left. He would consider he had been reasonably paid for his wasted day, but that would not stop him telling all and sundry the story of the disappearing Ford and its disappearing driver. The likelihood was that all this would get back to Captain Newman sooner or later. Newman might not know quite what to make of it all, but he would certainly feel that here was a mystery to be investigated. Wolf's mood darkened as he realized that his plan of slipping unobserved into Egypt might have failed. He would just have to make the best of it. He looked at his watch. He still had time to catch the train. He would be able to get rid of Cox in the lobby of the hotel, then get something to eat and drink while he was waiting, if he was quick. Cox was a short, dark man with some kind of British regional accent which Wolf could not identify. He looked about Wolf's age, and as he was still a corporal, he was probably not too bright. Following Wolf across the Midan el Mahata, he said, "You know this town, sir?" "I've been here before," Wolf replied. They entered the Grand. With 26 rooms, it was the larger of the town's 2 hotels. Wolf turned to Cox. "Thank you, Corporal. I think you could get back to work now."
"No hurry, sir," Cox said cheerfully. "I'll carry your bags upstairs."
"I'm sure they have porters here."
"Wouldn't trust them, sir, if I were you."
The situation was becoming more and more like a nightmare or a farce, in which well-intentioned people pushed him into increasingly senseless behavior in consequence of one small lie. He wondered again whether this was entirely accidental, and it crossed his mind with terrifying absurdity that perhaps they knew everything and were simply toying with him. He pushed the thought aside and spoke to Cox with as much grace as he could muster.
"Well, thank you."
He turned to the desk and asked for a room. He looked at his watch. He had 15 minutes left. He filled in the form quickly, giving an invented address in Cairo. There was a chance Captain Newman would forget the true address on the identity papers, and Wolf did not want to leave a reminder. A Nubian porter led them upstairs to the room. Wolf tipped him off at the door. Cox put the cases down on the bed. Wolf took out his wallet. Perhaps Cox expected a tip, too.
"Well, Corporal," he began, "you've been very helpful."
"Let me unpack for you, sir," Cox said. "Captain said not to leave anything to the Wogs."
"No, thank you," Wolf said firmly. "I want to lie down right now."
"You go ahead and lie down," Cox persisted generously. "It won't take me..."
"Don't open that."
Cox was lifting the lid of the case. Wolf reached inside his jacket, thinking, "Damn the man," and "Now I'm blown," and
I should have locked it. And can I do this quietly? The little corporal stared at the neat stacks of new English pound notes which filled the small case. He said, Jesus Christ, you're loaded! It crossed Wolf's mind, even as he stepped forward, that Cox had never seen so much money in his life. Cox began to turn, saying, What do you want with all that? Wolf pulled the wicked curved Bedouin knife, and it glinted in his hand as his eyes met Cox's. And Cox flinched and opened his mouth to shout, and then the razor-sharp blade sliced deeply into the soft flesh of his throat, and his shout of fear came as a bloody gurgle, and he died. And Wolf felt nothing, only disappointment. Chapter 2 It was May, and the Khamsin was blowing, a hot, dusty wind from the south. Standing under the shower, William Van Damme had the depressing thought that this would be the only time he would feel cool all day. He turned off the water and dried himself rapidly. His body was full of small aches. He had played cricket the day before for the first time in years. General Staff Intelligence had got up a team to play the doctors from the field hospital. Spies versus quacks, they had called it. And Van Damme, fielding on the boundary, had been run ragged as the medics hit the intelligence department's bowling all over the park. Now he had to admit he was not in good condition. Gin had sapped his strength, and cigarettes had shortened his wind, and he had too many worries to give the game the fierce concentration it merited. He lit a cigarette, coughed, and started to shave. He always smoked while he was shaving. It was the only way he knew to relieve the boredom of the inevitable daily task. 15 years ago, he had sworn he would grow a beard as soon as he got out of the army. But he was still in the army. He dressed in the everyday uniform. Heavy sandals, socks, bush shirt, and the khaki shorts with the flaps that could be let down and buttoned below the knee for protection against mosquitoes. Nobody ever used the flaps, and the younger officers usually cut them off. They looked so ridiculous. There was an empty gin bottle on the floor beside the bed. Van Damme looked at it, feeling disgusted with himself. It was the first time he had taken the damn bottle to bed with him. He picked it up, replaced the cap, and threw the bottle into the wastebasket. Then he went downstairs. Ghaffar was in the kitchen making tea. Van Damme's servant was an elderly Copt with a bald head and a shuffling walk, and pretensions to be an English butler. That he would never be. But he had a little dignity, and he was honest, and Van Damme had not found those qualities to be common among Egyptian house servants. Van Damme said, Is Billy up?
Yes, sir. He's coming down directly.
Van Damme nodded. A small pan of water was bubbling on the stove. Van Damme put an egg in to boil and set the timer. He cut two slices from an English-type loaf and made toast. He buttered the toast and cut it into fingers. Then he took the egg out of the water and decapitated it. Billy came into the kitchen and said, Good morning, Dad. Van Damme smiled at his 10-year-old son. Morning. Breakfast is ready. The boy began to eat. Van Damme sat opposite him with a cup of tea, watching. Billy often looked tired in the mornings recently. Once upon a time, he had been infallibly daisy fresh at breakfast. Was he sleeping badly? Or was his metabolism simply becoming more like an adult's? Perhaps it was just that he was staying awake late, reading detective stories under the sheet by the light of a flashlight. People said Billy was like his father, but Van Damme could not see the resemblance. However, he could see traces of Billy's mother, the gray eyes, the delicate skin, and the faintly supercilious expression which came over his face when someone crossed him. Van Damme always prepared his son's breakfast. The servant was perfectly capable of looking after the boy, of course, and most of the time he did. But Van Damme liked to keep this little ritual for himself. Often it was the only time he was with Billy all day. They did not talk much. Billy ate and Van Damme smoked. But that did not matter. The important thing was that they were together for a while at the start of each day. After breakfast, Billy brushed his teeth, while Ghaffar got out Van Damme's motorcycle.
Billy came back wearing his school cap, and Van Damme put on his uniform cap. As they did every day, they saluted each other. Billy said, "Right, sir. Let's go and win the war." Then they went out. Major Van Damme's office was at Gray Pillars, one of a group of buildings surrounded by barbed wire fencing, which made up GHQ Middle East. There was an incident report on his desk when he arrived. He sat down, lit a cigarette, and began to read. The report came from Asyut, 300 miles south, and at first Van Damme could not see why it had been marked for intelligence. A patrol had picked up a hitchhiking European who had subsequently murdered a corporal with a knife. The body had been discovered last night, almost as soon as the corporal's absence was noted, but several hours after the death. A man answering the hitchhiker's description had bought a ticket to Cairo at the railway station, but by the time the body was found, the train had arrived in Cairo and the killer had melted into the city. There was no indication of a motive. The Egyptian police force and the British military police would be investigating already in Asyut, and their colleagues in Cairo would, like Van Damme, be learning the details this morning. What reason was there for intelligence to get involved? Van Damme frowned and thought again. A European is picked up in the desert. He says his car has broken down. He checks into a hotel. He leaves a few minutes later and catches a train. His car is not found. The body of a soldier is discovered that night in the hotel room. Why? Van Damme got on the phone and called Asyut. It took the Army camp switchboard a while to locate Captain Newman, but eventually they found him in the arsenal and got him to a phone. Van Damme said, "This knife murder almost looks like a blown cover." "That occurred to me, sir," said Newman. He sounded a young man. "That's why I marked the report for intelligence." "Good thinking. Tell me, what was your impression of the man?" "He was a big chap." "I've got your description here. 6 foot, 12 stone, dark hair and eyes. But that doesn't tell me what he was like." "I understand," Newman said. "Well, to be candid, at first I wasn't in the least suspicious of him. He looked all in, which fitted with his story of having broken down on the desert road. But apart from that, he seemed an upright citizen. A white man, decently dressed, quite well-spoken, with an accent he said was Dutch. Or rather, Afrikaans. His papers were perfect. I'm still quite sure they were genuine. But he told me he was checking on his business interests in Upper Egypt."
"Plausible enough."
"Yes, but he didn't strike me as the kind of man to spend his life investing in a few shops and small factories and cotton farms. He was much more the assured cosmopolitan type. If he had money to invest, it would probably be with a London stockbroker or a Swiss bank. He just wasn't a small-timer. It's very vague, sir, but do you see what I mean?"
"Indeed." Newman sounded a bright chap, Van Damme thought. What was he doing stuck out in Asyut? Newman went on.
"And then it occurred to me that he had, as it were, just appeared in the desert, and I didn't really know where he might have come from. So I told poor old Cox to stay with him, on the pretense of helping him, to make sure he didn't do a bunk before we had a chance to check his story. I should have arrested the man, of course, but quite honestly, sir, at the time I had only the most slender suspicion."
"I don't think anyone's blaming you, Captain," said Van Damme. "You did well to remember the name and address from the papers. Alex Wolfe, Villa Les Oliviers, Garden City, right?"
"Yes, sir."
"All right. Keep me in touch with any developments at your end, will you?"
"Yes, sir."
Van Damme hung up.
Newman's suspicions chimed with his own instincts about the killing. He decided to speak to his immediate superior. He left his office carrying the incident report.
This ends side one of cassette one. Please turn the cassette over and start side two at the same point.
General Staff Intelligence was run by a brigadier with the title of Director of Military Intelligence. The DMI had two deputies, DDMI-O for operational and DDMI-I for intelligence. The deputies were colonels. Van Damme's boss, Lieutenant Colonel Bogg, came under the DDMI-I. Bogg was responsible for personnel security, and most of his time was spent administering the censorship apparatus. Van Damme's concern was security leaks by means other than letters. He and his men had several hundred agents in Cairo and Alexandria. In most clubs and bars, there was a waiter who was on his payroll. He had an informant among the domestic staffs of the more important Arab politicians. King Farouk's valet worked for Van Damme, and so did Cairo's wealthiest thief. He was interested in who was talking too much and who was listening. And among the listeners, Arab nationalists were his main target. However, it seemed possible that the mystery man from Assiout might be a different kind of threat. Van Damme's wartime career had so far been distinguished by one spectacular success and one great failure. The failure took place in Turkey. Rashid Ali had escaped there from Iraq. The Germans wanted to get him out and use him for propaganda. The British wanted him kept out of the limelight. And the Turks, jealous of their neutrality, wanted to offend nobody. Van Damme's job had been to make sure Ali stayed in Istanbul. But Ali had switched clothes with a German agent and slipped out of the country under Van Damme's nose. A few days later, he was making propaganda speeches to the Middle East on Nazi radio. Van Damme had somewhat redeemed himself in Cairo. London had told him they had reason to believe there was a major security leak there, and after 3 months of painstaking investigation, Van Damme had discovered that a senior American diplomat was reporting to Washington in an insecure code. The code had been changed. The leak had been stopped up, and Van Damme had been promoted to major. Had he been a civilian or even a peacetime soldier, he would have been proud of his triumph and reconciled to his defeat, and he would have said, "You win some, you lose some." But in war, an officer's mistakes killed people. In the aftermath of the Rashid Ali affair, an agent had been murdered, a woman, and Van Damme was not able to forgive himself for that. He knocked on Lieutenant Colonel Bogg's door and walked in. Reggie Bogg was a short, square man in his 50s, with an immaculate uniform and brilliantined black hair. He had a nervous, throat-clearing cough, which he used when he did not know quite what to say, which was often. He sat behind a huge, curved desk, bigger than the DMI's, going through his in-tray. Always willing to talk rather than work, he motioned Van Damme to a chair. He picked up a bright red cricket ball and began to toss it from hand to hand. "You played a good game yesterday," he said. "You didn't do badly yourself," Van Damme said. It was true. Bogg had been the only decent bowler on the intelligence team, and his slow googlies had taken 4 wickets for 42 runs. "But are we winning the war?" "More bloody bad news, I'm afraid." The morning briefing had not yet taken place, but Bogg always heard the news by word of mouth beforehand. "We expected Rommel to attack the Gazala line head-on. He should have known better. Fellow never fights fair and square. He went around our southern flank, took the 7th Armored's headquarters, and captured General Messervy." It was a depressingly familiar story, and Van Damme suddenly felt weary. "What a shambles," he said. "Fortunately, he failed to get through to the coast, so the divisions on the Gazala line didn't get isolated. Still, when are we going to stop him?" "He won't get much farther." It was an idiotic remark. Bogg simply did not want to get involved in criticism of generals. "What have you got there?" Van Damme gave him the incident report. "I propose to follow this one through myself." Bogg read the paper and looked up, his face blank. "I don't see the point." "It looks like a blown cover." "Huh?" "There's no motive for the murder, so we have to speculate," Van Damme explained. "Here's one possibility. The hitchhiker was not what he said he was. And the corporal discovered that fact, and so the hitchhiker killed the corporal."
"Not what he said he was? You mean he was a spy?"
Bogg laughed.
"How do you suppose he got to Assiut? By parachute? Or did he walk?"
That was the trouble with explaining things to Bogg, thought Van Damme. He had to ridicule the idea as an excuse for not thinking of it himself. "It's not impossible for a small plane to sneak through, it's not impossible to cross the desert, either. Boggs sailed the report through the air across the vast expanse of his desk.
Not very likely, in my view, he said. Don't waste any time on that one.
Very good, sir. Van Damme picked up the report from the floor, suppressing the familiar frustrated anger. Conversations with Bog always turned into point-scoring contests, and the smart thing to do was not to play. I'll ask the police to keep us informed of their progress, copies of memos and so on, just for the file.
Yes.
Bog never objected to making people send him copies for the file. It enabled him to poke his finger into things without taking any responsibility.
Listen, how about arranging some cricket practice? I noticed they had nets and a catching boat there yesterday. I'd like to lick our team into shape and get some more matches going.
Good idea.
See if you can organize something, will you?
Yes, sir. Van Damme went out. On the way back to his own office, he wondered what was so wrong with the administration of the British Army that it could promote to Lieutenant Colonel a man as empty-headed as Reggie Bogg. Van Damme's father, who had been a corporal in the First War, had been fond of saying that British soldiers were lions led by donkeys. Sometimes Van Damme thought it was still true. But Bogg was not merely dull. Sometimes he made bad decisions because he was not clever enough to make good decisions. But mostly, it seemed to Van Damme, Bogg made bad decisions because he was playing some other game, making himself look good, or trying to be superior, or something. Van Damme did not know what. A woman in a white hospital coat saluted him, and he returned the salute, absent-mindedly. The woman said, "Major Van Damme, isn't it?" He stopped and looked at her. She had been a spectator at the cricket match, and now he remembered her name. "Dr. Abathnot," he said. "Good morning." She was a tall, cool woman of about his age. He recalled that she was a surgeon, highly unusual for a woman, even in wartime, and that she held the rank of captain. She said, "You worked hard yesterday." Van Damme smiled. "And I'm suffering for it today. I enjoyed myself, though." "So did I." She had a low, precise voice and a great deal of confidence. "Shall we see you on Friday?"
"Where?"
"The reception at the Union."
"Ah."
The Anglo-Egyptian Union, a club for bored Europeans, made occasional attempts to justify its name by holding a reception for Egyptian guests.
"I'd like that. What time?"
5 o'clock for tea." Van Damme was professionally interested. It was an occasion at which Egyptians might pick up service gossip, and service gossip sometimes included information useful to the enemy.
"I'll come," he said.
"Splendid. I'll see you there." She turned away.
"I look forward to it," Van Damme said to her back.
He watched her walk away, wondering what she wore under the hospital coat. She was trim, elegant, and self-possessed. She reminded him of his wife. He entered his office. He had no intention of organizing a cricket practice, and he had no intention of forgetting about the Assiut murder. Bogg could go to hell. Van Damme would go to work. First he spoke again to Captain Newman and told him to make sure the description of Alex Wolfe got the widest possible circulation. He called the Egyptian police and confirmed that they would be checking the hotels and flophouses of Cairo today. He contacted Field Security, a unit of the pre-war Canal Defense Force, and asked them to step up their spot checks on identity papers for a few days. He told the British Paymaster General to keep a special watch for forged currency. He advised the wireless listening service to be alert for a new local transmitter, and thought briefly how useful it would be if the Boffins ever cracked the problem of locating a radio by monitoring its broadcasts. Finally, he detailed a sergeant on his staff to visit every radio shop in Lower Egypt. There were not many, and asked them to report any sales of parts and equipment which might be used to make or repair a transmitter. Then he went to the Villa Les Oliviers. The house got its name from a small public garden across the street, where a grove of olive trees was now in bloom, shedding white petals like dust onto the dry, broken grass. The house had a high wall broken by a heavy, carved wooden gate. Using the ornamentation for footholds, Van Damme climbed over the gate and dropped on the other side to find himself in a large courtyard. Around him, the whitewashed walls were smeared and grubby, their windows blinded by closed, peeling shutters. He walked to the center of the courtyard and looked at the stone fountain. A bright green lizard darted across the dry bowl. The place had not been lived in for at least a year. Van Damme opened a shutter, broke a pane of glass, reached through to unfasten the window, and climbed over the sill into the house. It did not look like the home of a European, he thought as he walked through the dark, cool rooms. There were no hunting prints on the walls, no neat rows of bright-jacketed novels by Agatha Christie and Dennis Wheatley, no three-piece suite imported from Maples or Harrods. Instead, the place was furnished with large cushions and low tables, hand-woven rugs and hanging tapestries. Upstairs, he found a locked door. It took him 3 or 4 minutes to kick it open. Behind it, there was a study. The room was clean and tidy, with a few pieces of rather luxurious furniture. A wide, low divan covered in velvet. A hand-carved coffee table. 3 matching antique lamps. A bearskin rug. A beautifully inlaid desk. And a leather chair. On the desk were a telephone, a clean white blotter, an ivory-handled pen, and a dry inkwell. In the desk drawer, Van Damme found company reports from Switzerland, Germany, and the United States. A delicate beaten copper coffee service gathered dust on the little table. On a shelf behind the desk were books in several languages, 19th-century French novels, the shorter Oxford Dictionary, a volume of what appeared to Van Damme to be Arabic poetry, with erotic illustrations, and the Bible in German. There were no personal documents. There were no letters. There was not a single photograph in the house. Van Damme sat in the soft leather chair behind the desk and looked around the room. It was a masculine room, the home of a cosmopolitan intellectual, a man who was on the one hand careful, precise, and tidy, and on the other hand sensitive and sensual. Van Damme was intrigued. A European name, a totally Arabic house. A pamphlet about investing in business machines. A book of Arab verse. An antique coffee jug and a modern telephone. A wealth of information about a character, but not a single clue which might help find the man. The room had been carefully cleaned out. There should have been bank statements, bills from tradesmen, a birth certificate, and a will, letters from a lover, and photographs of parents or children. The man had collected all those things and taken them away, leaving no trace of his identity, as if he knew that one day someone would come looking for him. Van Damme said aloud, "Alex Wolfe, who are you?" He got up from the chair and left the study. He walked through the house and across the hot, dusty courtyard. He climbed back over the gate and dropped into the street. Across the road, an Arab in a green-striped galabiyah sat cross-legged on the ground, in the shade of the olive trees, watching Van Damme incuriously. Van Damme felt no impulse to explain that he had broken into the house on official business. The uniform of a British officer was authority enough for just about anything in this town. He thought of the other sources from which he could seek information about the owner of this house. Municipal records, such as they were. Local tradesmen who might have delivered there when the place was occupied, even the neighbors. He would put 2 of his men onto it and tell Boggs some story to cover up. He climbed onto his motorcycle and kicked it into life. The engine roared enthusiastically, and Van Damme drove away. Chapter 3. Full of anger and despair, Wolfe sat outside his home and watched the British officer drive away. He remembered the house as it had been when he was a boy, loud with talk and laughter and life. There by the great carved gate there had always been a guard, a black-skinned giant from the south, sitting on the ground, impervious to the heat. Each morning a holy man, old and almost blind, would recite a chapter from the Koran in the courtyard. In the cool of the arcade on 3 sides, the men of the family would sit on low divans and smoke their hubble bubbles while servant boys brought coffee in long-necked jugs. Another black guard stood at the door to the harem, behind which the women grew bored and fat. The days were long and warm. The family was rich, and the children were indulged. The British officer, with his shorts and his motorcycle, his arrogant face and his prying eyes hidden in the shadow of the peaked uniform cap, had broken in and violated Wolf's childhood. Wolf wished he could have seen the man's face, for he would like to kill him one day. He had thought of this place all through his journey, in Berlin and Tripoli and Alagela, in the pain and exhaustion of the desert crossing, in the fear and haste of his flight from Assiut. The villa had represented a safe haven, a place to rest and get clean and whole again at the end of the voyage. He had looked forward to lying in the bath and sipping coffee in the courtyard and bringing women home to the great bed. Now he would have to go away and stay away. He had remained outside all morning, alternately walking the street and sitting under the olive trees, just in case Captain Newman should have remembered the address and sent somebody to search the house. And he had bought a galabeah in the souk beforehand, knowing that if someone did come, they would be looking for a European, not an Arab. It had been a mistake to show genuine papers. He could see that with hindsight. The trouble was, he mistrusted Abwehr forgeries. Meeting and working with other spies, he had heard horror stories about crass and obvious errors in the documents made by German intelligence. Botched printing, inferior quality paper, even misspellings of common English words. In the spy school where he had been sent for his wireless cipher course, the current rumor had been that every policeman in England knew that a certain series of numbers on a ration card identified the holder as a German spy. Wolf had weighed the alternatives and picked what seemed the least risky. He had been wrong, and now he had no place to go. He stood, picked up his cases, and began to walk. He thought of his family. His mother and his stepfather were dead, but he had three stepbrothers.